Try to get in the room where those decisions are being made. Even if you're not contributing and just being a fly on the wall, get in that room. Because the earlier you can understand why these decisions are being made, why this project was greenlit versus another project, if you can start understanding that, you're bringing so much more to the table when you're deciding, oh, this is a project I think we should work on.
Today we have with us someone who has a passion for mentoring and educating data science aspirants. He's also a machine learning blogger, YouTuber. He works as a lead data scientist in a company which has shaped our imagination during our childhood, the Walt Disney Company. He has demonstrated the prowess for machine learning and data manipulation, and at the same time, communicate effectively and concisely. Today we have a variety of topics to cover, ranging from how Madhav got into data science, his favorite tips for data science aspirants, how he applies machine learning in his current role, and much more. Welcome, Madhav.
Thank you. Thank you for the warm introduction. I appreciate that.
Madhav, you have done your bachelor's of science, aerospace engineering, along with minors in computer science, and you are a part of Skydiving Club. How did you decide to move from skydiving to your first deep dive into data science? Tell us more about the decision-making process to fully take up data science.
Yeah, it's a great question. So if I think back to undergrad, data really wasn't on my thought process. It wasn't in my trajectory at all. I think my assumption at that point, I was going to work for a large aerospace company, work for large commercial airliners, work on design work. That was really my goal, my dream at that point. My whole world revolved around aviation. It wasn't until I was working at Boeing, was working on the Dreamliner 787 and working on my quote unquote dream job where I realized it's not for me. It really wasn't, it didn't connect. It wasn't the atmosphere that I really needed for my first job out of undergrad. That coincided with the rise of data, and I was already involved with a lot of the analytics groups within Boeing. So with that kind of coincidence and that perfect timing, I decided, let me just explore data science a bit more. I have the computer science background. So just from my own coursework, I realized this is something that I'm interested in. And luckily, Boeing allowed me to get my master's in data science with them footing the bill, which is how I started my data science career. It was really these random events and discussions I had with the analytics organization at Boeing, seeing how they forecasted certain metrics, etc. I just instantly clicked. This is something that I found more interesting than the work that I was actually doing on a day-to-day basis, which immediately for me realized I need to shift and course correct and decide to go towards a more data-driven profession versus aerospace.
Absolutely. And so when you were working in Boeing, can you remember some of the instances that you first worked with, like in some of the metrics that you first worked with, or let's say worked on some use cases that involved machine learning? Can you walk us through some of those examples?
Yeah, definitely. There's one project that I thought was really interesting that I was able to get my hands like dirty with. So with all of these projects, there's so many components, right? There's prep work, there's modeling, like this is for the actual engineering projects, the aerospace projects, modeling, the SCUM, FEA, finite element analysis, then there's getting approval, whatnot. There's many components, and these components can take a wide variety of lengths depending on what part of the plane, how urgent, etc. What we found was an issue is we weren't able, like they weren't able to properly schedule projects and really forecast how long a project would take based off of the early inputs of what this project might be. So these inputs can be anything like, is this going to be approved by the FAA? Is it a part of the wing? How severe is the damage? All of these little inputs is something that we know earlier on. What we tried to do is use those inputs to forecast the amount of time we estimate and the amount of overall complexity we estimate for a specific project. And that was interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it allowed us to optimize how much time we're allocating for a specific project, but also allocate which resources should be on a specific project versus others. I think we found out that many instances we would put maybe someone more junior on a project thinking it'd be good enough for him, a good match. And then 2 weeks into it, we realized, wow, this is way too complex for him. And then that switch obviously requires more time. It's not very efficient. Yeah, that was really like the first project. And it was very simple. It was just a regression model. It wasn't anything too fancy or complex, but we had a wide variety of things that we had 35 different features that were fed into this model to predict the amount of weeks a project will take.
And it reminds me of those days where when I was trying to get into machine learning, or in fact, anybody who's trying to get into machine learning, they see that the whole fancy thing is running models and all of that.
Yeah.
But when you actually get into it, you're reminded to be all about that data prep, right? Okay, I'm getting this data from here, that data from here, and in how it's all going to make sense. So basically, speaking of this data prep and all of that thing, like, were you equipped with all of the tricks or skills to like manipulate data early on, or it was like, it was time consuming for you, or what was your journey when you were suddenly faced with so much of data manipulation?
Yeah, I think because that was so earlier on, and even before I started my master's, my involvement was quite limited. It was the data engineers and data analytics team did a lot of the data massaging, right? Because they took this very raw data straight from the API and converted it into a very tabular format. So at that moment, that's not something I was really doing. My main focus was feature engineering. So taking this tabulated data and creating nuanced features that we think would be really useful for the model, and then also building the model. But as you just mentioned, building the model is probably the quickest piece of this whole puzzle. It takes like 3-4 lines of code really to do that part. So yeah, it was more of getting experience with the feature engineering, and also for me, because it was so early on, really getting hands dirty with pandas and a lot of the data manipulation features within Python, really getting my hands dirty there. So yeah, that was mainly my focus early on.
Speaking of pandas, so when you started using it, obviously pandas was just evolving that time, but
totally.
Currently now pandas has evolved in bigger ways. And do you see like a significant difference in how you used to handle things using pandas back then and now how pandas can handle things?
It's funny. I feel like with the how pandas has evolved, I feel like now my code's a lot more concise. I think they've just added so many features to make things more efficient. But if I'm honest, I think as I've gone into larger scales of data, right? So when I was at ZS, we worked with something called patient level data, which, as you'd imagine, is a massive data set. And also with Disney, I'm using customer engagement data, which is also massive. So at this point, when I think feature engineering, when I think data manipulation, pandas isn't even my first thought anymore. It completely goes straight to PySpark, Databricks, notebooks to actually work with the data at this point. Because pandas is good to just understand, okay, let me start thinking like a data scientist, thinking how I should start processing my data, whatnot. But when you start working in the quote unquote big leagues, right, it's not really usable. It's almost impossible. I'm trying to imagine like a current project I'm working on my local machine on pandas. It would break immediately. So now I think on a day-to-day basis, I'm using more EMR clusters, Databricks clusters, and PySpark to do any feature engineering or data manipulation.
Absolutely. Some of the like the data science aspirants that you teach, right? And some of the things that I've also observed is that a lot of courses focus on teaching pandas, right? And there are like very few course takers, people that take Spark or advanced knowledge and all of that thing. But so when you mentor, like, how do you prepare the data science aspirants? Okay, like you're starting with pandas, but then how you eventually transition them into like Spark or any other bigger platforms where data can be handled, much bigger data can be handled?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I would agree with kind of most educators that you should start with Python, pandas. I think it gives you just such a great framework as a data scientist for building your own projects, building your own portfolio. Not everything's going to be at the scale that we're working with here. So it's a great place to dive in. But I always recommend, so what I try to tell some of the junior data scientists here, right? Carve out some time each sprint or every 2-week period, take a project you did and convert it to Spark. And that's my usually first tidbit of advice. Don't start from scratch in Spark. That's really difficult. What I say is, okay, you've built this set of features, right? Can you replicate that with some integrity in Spark? And that's my first kind of step. My first, for any junior data scientist, how I expose them to Spark. That's usually been the best way for me, because then they can easily say, oh, like, this is my pandas code. I can easily translate that to Spark. Usually the best way for them to adapt.
Yeah, I think so. It reminds me of how I learned dashboarding. I used to use Excel to create small little dashboards, and then I got a hang of it so much so that when I moved to Tableau or Power BI, things became a lot easier because I knew in the background how it works, right? And so,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think what's exciting about, I don't know if you've been following a lot going on with Spark, but Spark 3.0 is very Pythonic in nature. So okay. It's going to be exciting because now those that are really fluent with pandas can immediately scale to Spark, which is going to be really cool. I'm really excited to see where that goes.
I'll definitely check that out. Okay. So moving to your entrepreneurial efforts with Let's Hang, you have learned some valuable lessons which have parallels to data science, and I couldn't help but relate it there, right? So you have the first one that is embrace rejections for data science. It will be embrace ambiguity and failure. Move fast. For data science, we need not over-engineer algorithms from the get-go. Like you start with a base model and then you keep iterating it. And then keep it simple for data science, like interpretability of the models. So when moving into data science, there are some expectations. You have some expectation, but when you are actually in the data science field, your perspective changes, right? So could you give us to the data science aspirants that are there, what to expect? It's not always green on sites. It's a lot of hard work, but what to expect and then how they can systematically work towards some of those loopholes that they can easily get into?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think when I say what to expect, it really varies. So I'm going to take my experience as, say, a applied data scientist that's not doing more research, but more like in a Fortune 500 company. I'll give that perspective. I think what people underestimate the most is the communication skills required to be a great data scientist. If you want to work for a large company, like even say Facebook, Google, right? I'm not talking about applied scientists. That's a very different role than I think a wide majority of data scientists, right?
Yeah.
Like being able to coach her, I think that's just a baseline. You're going to be able to know how to do that if you're going into those positions. But being able to communicate a complex concept to people who are inherently not technical is the number one skill set that I believe I use, that I believe any excellent data scientist has in the corporate environment. So I think that's the big misconception I think a lot of entry-level data scientists have, is they go into, say, a Disney, even a Google, or what have you, and they believe, oh, I'm going to be in a Jupyter notebook all day, and I'm going to be using TensorFlow or Keras, etc. It's just so far from the truth because... And it's unfortunate because people don't realize that a lot of the data science work is qualitative, which just seems so unintuitive. You wouldn't think a data scientist's role would be qualitative, but it is a lot of storytelling and explaining why this model works the way it does, what assumptions need to be taken, and explaining that to, say, an executive who knows nothing about data. I think that is the most important role of a data scientist and the least talked about skill for anyone in undergrad or master's going to become a data scientist. I know that's not technical, has nothing to do with the data, but I kid you not, I think we've had so many people, so many new graduates come into our team upset. Like you could tell they were just blindsided by the fact that they had to build presentations. They were presenting to stakeholders very often. And that's the one thing I try to avoid. I think everyone needs to be aware of that. If they're looking to go at a big corporation and work in those roles, they need to be aware of that. And this is like another, sorry, I'm going on and on, but ZS Associates, right? I know one of your colleagues, he's now going to be working as a DS associate there. That's also common. Like even there, sure, there's a lot of modeling and coding, but people do get taken aback by the amount of slides that you have to build while working there. It's not talked about nearly enough.
Yep, absolutely. I've awarded to a good 5 years of my life not making presentations, but eventually it'll creep on you. Yeah. But surprisingly enough, Madhav, I've not seen any courses that take you from a point like once regression has ended, you have an accuracy, or let's say a logistic model accuracy has ended, from that point on, how do you make a presentation? Like, how do you see your stakeholders' perspective? What are you trying to sell? How do you structure the slides? So did you find any course on structuring presentations after you get results from any machine learning output or something like that?
That's so funny that you mentioned that. And no, there definitely isn't anything. I think it sounds like so cheesy, but a storytelling or data storytelling course would be invaluable if you're an undergraduate student. It would be so useful. And it's something I've been thinking about, putting together some content that shows how I would go about doing that. Because to your point, it's a massive gap in the data science education field. No one talks about it. It's not sexy, right? It's not like building a new GAN network. It's just not the same and no one talks about it. But yeah, to your point, I think it's a great piece of content we could put out.
Okay, so Madhav, if you have to take a stab at structuring some, let's say, top 5 points for presentations, and since you have already so many presentations with SVBs and VPs, so if you have to take, say, top 5 rules or let's say, decisions or frameworks that you have in mind to make presentations, that'll be valuable for our audience. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so, it obviously will depend on the level of kind of stakeholder you're working with, but you said VP, SEB. So say someone who's very high up. Naturally, my first thought would be, don't go into that much detail into the model. I always have this concept that make it complex enough so they realize your worth, but not so complex where the eyes glaze over and they become bored. It's this very sweet spot, because if you make it so simple to them, they're like, oh, why do we even need you? It's something I dealt with a lot in consulting. It's this magic sweet spot. So what I'll typically do is build a slide that really has a high level kind of overview of what an XGBoost model is or something like that. So if I think about the flow, I would say, okay, this is the problem statement. We noticed that we weren't properly projecting the amount of time a project would take. And we noticed that this cost us $3 million or X million dollars a year. Our solution is take a set of inputs and predict what will happen. That's the overview slide to get everyone on the same page. And usually people like that because they could take that and use that for their own stakeholders.
Cascaded, yeah.
Exactly, right? Because you always want, because what I like to do in any presentation I build is have one slide that they could take wherever they go, a one slider that they can then leverage. So once I've done that, I then first go into the performance. So that's usually flip-flop with a lot of other folks. They'll first talk about the methodology and then talk about performance. But the reason I like to do that is you want to build trust with these really high-level folks so that they're not questioning the methodology, etc. So I'll tell them immediately, okay, F1 score, precision and recall was XYZ. Then they trust what I built. They realize, wow, this is good. Then anything I explain after the fact, they're more engaged. They're more excited about that content. And then, like I said, after that, I give a very, not too high level, but I'll show some of the components of what goes into a certain model, but I go through pretty quickly. I don't spend too much time on it because, like I mentioned, if it's too complex, they get really frustrated. They eyes glaze over because, look, regardless of if you're a junior or a VP, you have your own insecurities. If you're showing them stuff that they can't even understand remotely, they get very defensive.
Yep.
So I don't go through it too much. I keep it at a pretty high level and then I'll wrap it up. So my presentations are pretty brief. Really, I like to just have it be a very open dialogue, but those are the few points I'd like to touch. What the problem statement was, how we plan to attack that problem statement, how did we actually do, then a very high level overview of the model itself and why it's complex and why you needed a data scientist to do this and why someone else couldn't. And then next steps, right? Because data scientists aren't always building production models. They're just prototyping at times. So then I take, okay, based off what we did, we can productionalize this within the next 5 weeks and it would cost X, Y, Z, et cetera. But that's typically the framework I like to use when I'm presenting to anyone high level.
I think
I know that was a bit verbose, but I hope that was helpful.
No, I think we can more or less have the skeleton and then expand from it also. Especially SVPs and VPs. Now, speaking of presentation, one thing also I faced, and a lot of others I mentored, they also faced the same thing, is the aesthetics and the looks and the designs, right? Who knew that as a data science, I have to learn aesthetics and designs and all
That's
of
so
that?
So funny.
So how did you work on that? And what was your first story of the most shabbiest presentation and today, how your presentation style has changed?
I get like chills thinking about the feedback I was getting on my first presentation. So my first actual data science job was in consulting and it was at ZS Associates. And there was a lot of slide making. And I worked so long on this one presentation, tried to make it pretty and like aesthetically pleasing. And my manager at the time, I've never heard such harsh criticism on anything I've ever done in my life. It was just, he was just like, who are you going to show this to? This is disgusting. Like, why would you even put this together? Why is this block there? Like, why is this so bold? Right? This is so disgusting. Are you going to show this to? I wouldn't even show this to my mom. Like, he was just saying the most terrible things to me ever. And I wish I had a process to improve, but literally it's just muscle memory and practice makes perfect, because I was there for 2.5 years. And over that time, you start to figure things out, but it's just doing, just keep building slides, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that was, I think being in consulting, all as miserable as I was because of just the insane hours, my communication and presentation building skills went through the roof. If that's something you want to build and that's something that's important to you, if you want to be in a leadership position, I honestly, starting your career off in consulting is such a great thing to do. Yeah, great thing to do.
All the big fives, if you go there, you're just churning presentations out of the presentations, and then you have a lot of... Another thing that you mentioned, Madhav, I wanted to bring the focus for our audience on that attention, is that often I see a lot of junior data scientists get disappointed that their proof of concept did not go through to production. And I'm sure when we, you're a senior data scientist, you have seen much more projects go down the... go into the shelf, and you see a very few projects going into production. So how do data science aspirants handle this kind of situation? Because, you know, a lot of data scientists spend a lot of time, junior data scientists spend a lot of time doing that project, like to the heart of it, but there is a time where you need to cut short and know that, okay, this is going to be a POC and this is going to go to production, all of that. So what's your experience there?
My experience is very similar to what you said. I've never taken those things personally. So it's just, I think, very pragmatic in that sense. At the end of the day, there's a very expensive business decision on whether a project goes forward. And I understand that. The feedback that I gave, that now I give to any junior data scientist, is think about what you got from this experience. Sure, it's not in production, but what did you get from this? One, it's a great thing for your portfolio and your resume, right? Regardless of if it went through or not, it's great experience. Also, on your portfolio, if you could show that there was a very pragmatic reason that you and the team took to not put this forward, that looks so great on the resume as well. And then it's a bit of a cliche, but I really sit them down and analyze, what did you actually gain from this? What technical skills did you gain from this project that you will now be able to use on any other project moving forward? And that's how I think of every project, because if I always think about the end goal and whether or not it made me $5 million in our organization, if that's the only criteria for success, I'm never going to be happy. You know what I mean? So I encourage anyone to consistently focus on what you're actually building throughout any data science project within your workforce, and use that to propel yourself forward and keep yourself motivated. That's the only advice I can give, really, because people get upset and there's nothing you could do, but just think big picture. You got to think, there's just so... Yeah, it's just, there's so many components that execs take that.
As a data scientist, like, we are always curious about, okay, here's the new idea. You keep adding them to the backlog and keep solving them until one idea really hits. That's how, I mean, it's a number game, I guess.
And what I encourage those, and what I did a lot earlier on, I feel like that helped me out quite a bit, is try to get in the room where those decisions are being made. Even if you're not contributing, just being a fly on the wall, get in that room. Because the earlier you can understand why these decisions being made, why this project was greenlit versus another project, if you can start understanding that, you're bringing so much more to the table when you're ideating. You're bringing so much more to the table when you're deciding, oh, this is a project I think we should work on. If you can have that sort of like executive mindset at an early age, super valuable. So if you have a manager, director, etc., there's no harm in asking, hey, I saw that you had this meeting to discuss XYZ projects. Can I attend? Yep. Something as simple as that will go a long way in your data science career.
Yep. And I think so. A lot of aspirants miss this part of it, like being on meetings you shouldn't be in just so that you can learn things or connect the dots, absolutely, especially when interconnecting teams are involved, when our team's work impacts some other teams. Okay. And if you just like sitting there on the meeting, you get the whole perspective that nobody else would actually ideally give it to you on a normal day.
You bring up such a great... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
No, you bring up such a great point. I think there probably isn't a position that's so interconnected with so many different groups in an organization. If I think about myself, consistently working with software engineers, data engineers, marketing, product managers, and then executives, right? So there's not really a team that I'm not heavily connected with. So if you don't have that big picture view, you're almost limited as a data scientist, because how do you actually help all these people appropriately? Yeah. So it's your Achilles heel if you just think about your work and not understand how it plays a role in the big picture.
Absolutely. You wear a lot of hats and you work with a lot of other teams also. And data engineering team is one of them. And so although you build the model and you transition it to them, but then scaling it becomes one of the biggest issues. And it's more a hardware problem than a data science problem. But then you have to wear that hat, understand those nuances, because you understand something that works and need to work at scale. So how do data science aspirants need to prepare for the hardware aspects? How much should they understand and to be able to navigate in this career?
That's such a great question. It's important to understand what computational resources would be required. And I think any data scientist can get that feeling. What EC2 machine can actually handle this road, right? Do we need an M16 or M4, right? What would actually work for our use case? If you realize that, you would need several GPUs to run this model. Does it make sense? That's how I like to think, is would I need the cutting edge, the largest model, largest resources possible to run this model? If that's the case, that is it actually worth it? And that sort of thought process of understanding, okay, what did it actually take to run this on all of our users? And is that something we were willing to spend? There's this problem. It's a complexity versus performance, right? Like lower complexity probably has lower performance, and just finding that balance and figuring out what works for your stakeholders. Because going on a bit of a tangent here, but if we think about something like medicine and we're thinking about, say, cancer detection, in that case, you will put as much money, as much resources, as much computation power to get the most performance possible, right? But for a recommendation engine, maybe not as much, right? You have more leeway because it's not as high risk, high reward. So that's how I like to think about it, is, okay, can we get away with slightly less performance, but less computational kind of expensive process? And sure, just thinking about that, if you just go through this whole process of thinking about, okay, do we need the utmost performance or model performance? Can we get away with the less computationally expensive model? Those thought processes can help you when you start prototyping, because you don't go on this rabbit hole of starting to build this neural network that will never ever go to production because it's just not scalable. Yeah, that's kind of like understanding what's appropriate for the end state is really important, like what you should even be prototyping.
Yeah, absolutely. And basically, we can definitely use like the most complex model. But again, if you think end goal, then we'll also have to think a lot of other factors. Okay.
That's a great point. I think a lot of people don't think about, can this even scale? Like many don't even consider it. So true.
Yeah, I've had many conversations where, we could just get away with a logistic regression here. The difference is only 2-3%, but computationally it's going to be expensive. Some of them don't listen. They go to production and then they realize, oh, it's taking too much time to get the output. So let's switch back to the old models.
It's so funny that you mentioned that. Literally yesterday, the junior data scientist on my team, we're going to work on this one engagement forecasting model. And her first question, without talking about what's our baseline model going to be, what features should we tackle? First question was, should we use a neural network? And that's just an inherent issue with the industry at the moment, because it's what's sexy and people aren't focusing on the core methodologies. But I think the most appropriate question that I asked was, why? Like, why do you want to use a neural network? And then just because on Slack, there was just no response for 3 hours, I realized there was no answer to that. None at all. Yes. But I don't get too mad, because I think that's just how people are getting educated today. But it's such an issue that their first thought is to go with the most complex approach. It's so frustrating.
Absolutely. And I think that's where the opportunity of mentoring lies, because a lot of these nuances that you typically get to face when you're in the industry is not given to you in any course. Like, you get it bits and pieces, but only through a mentor will you be able to get the full picture and to progress.
Absolutely.
Okay, speaking of this, another aspect that is close to my heart and not many people will appreciate it is metrics. I have not seen any full-fledged course that will tell you how to design a metric, how do you design a lag indicator, or how do you design a lead indicator, what should be businesses focusing on, what should be the performance reports be focused around. And so what are your thoughts basically about metrics, first of all?
Well, that's a lot. That's a big question. I think my thoughts are obviously it's critical, right? I think to your point, we've had in the past month and a half, we've had several workshops to revamp the entire KPI framework for our entire organization, like literally like end to end. I think you would have absolutely loved this. No, because what we did is we went from the ground up. So there's like engagement, transactions, there's specific feature-based metrics. So we went from, the way we looked at it is, let's go from the ground level and start rolling it up and build layered KPIs that any level of person in the organization can consume. Because what we wanted is a North Star for literally everyone in the organization. And right. So if you're doing the actual code to build a feature, you want them to focus on that feature-based KPI. And then if you have, say, a middle-level manager, they want to know how this cluster of features are performing. And that's how we built it out. And the metric itself, I think that's not as difficult to understand. It's like things like, say, recommendation engine, the click-through rate, the amount of impressions, the amount of transactions. It's easy to understand that. But rolling it up was the most critical piece, because what we've found is prior to this initiative, everyone was focusing on how many transactions, how many new users, and that was just not useful, right? It's not useful for a guy focusing personally on personalization to focus on these very vague metrics. So creating that very tiered approach and creating, so we have a, called a QBR, but essentially like quarterly metric milestones and pretty much goals that we want to achieve. So now that we have those quarterly goals at every level of granularity, no one doesn't have that kind of North Star to look towards. And it was a huge initiative. I feel like if I thought about the hours that were put into building this framework, it was a lot. It's a lot of time and money spent, but it's so critical. And you bring up a great point. No one talks about it. It's, again, something that's not sexy. It's not fun to discuss, but giving people that goal at every level is the most critical thing you could do within a data organization, or any organization for that matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. We can go all about how to create metrics and all of that thing. Some of the things that I always ask the data science aspirants is that, hey, what metric? Look at this data. I know you have to do an EDA, but look at what kind of reporting metrics can you layer? What's the main metric that people are interested in? What are the sub-metrics that people will be interested in? And that's like a fun way to connect with any stakeholders easily, because then you speak their language.
Exactly. Okay. That's so true.
You work in the Movies Anywhere organization where you work on recommendation engines, customer lifecycle value, and customer segmentation. Yep. Now, all of these three things are not fancy for currently anybody who's pursuing data science, but I myself have seen customer segmentation as a big valuable part of a marketing organization. I work in marketing, so that's literally what I'm doing every time, just customer segmentation and targeting and messaging. That's the work that I'm doing. So could you give us why these recommendation engines, customer lifecycle, and customer segmentation, these are like pretty easy to pick up, but their interpretation and all of those things are much more valuable. And could you share some light on how these things are very important and a data science aspirant should look forward to be learning these low-hanging algorithms?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And I think that's also a common misconception I feel is there's never really an out-of-the-box solution for any one of these that works in an organization. So as the model is simple, but usually these projects are very complex, because to get a customer segmentation model to work on a specific data set takes a lot of time and effort, and it's truly complex. And for Movies Anywhere, it's a very interesting business model, because what we're in the movie purchasing space, and that's Disney's kind of movie purchasing arm, because they're trying to obviously sell, upsell quite a bit. And what's tricky about that is you could purchase movies anywhere, or movie, well, that's funny, but movies in like Amazon or et cetera, but you could also purchase on our product. So for us, it's really tricky is what's the incremental lift a purchaser gets from being on Movies Anywhere versus purchasing elsewhere? Because we're a very unique platform that makes purchasing very easy, but you could still purchase anywhere. You could purchase in any product. So that was a very tricky lifetime value problem, right? Because it wasn't very straightforward, like plug in to the very rudimentary, like rudimentary formula that we have. We had to say, okay, how do we say what the baseline is, and how do we say what the incremental lift that Movies Anywhere actually provides to the user? So it's funny because on the resume, and this could be a fault of my own and not being too descriptive, but it says customer lifetime value, but the model itself was something completely like out of our own box, right? It's not something we could actually leverage. So it's something we built from scratch to suit our need. And I think that happens more often than we think, because if you want the best results that you could use moving forward, usually you'll have to build something tailored to you. Even the recommendation engine, right? Collaborative filtering worked really poorly, completely poorly because of the nuanced data. So from scratch, I had to build an entire recommendation engine that took all this metadata, all these other features, and created, this is getting too dense, but created representations of a user persona. That's something that isn't taught in any book. So sure, the title is generic recommendation system, but it's completely nuanced and specific to MA versus any other organization.
Absolutely. It's like a pro footballer giving a flip kick near the football, in a goalpost somewhere. Yeah. You know, you're doing some cool stuff, but nobody's really cheering for you.
Exactly. No, it's so true. It's so true. And even with the customer segmentation, it's getting that right. I think this probably because you're working on it so often, but getting the feature engineering right for a customer segmentation model is immensely difficult, and it's so understated. I think at the end of it, we had 160 different features that varied, interesting, nuanced features within our customer engagement, the types of movies they're watching, the types of movies they're purchasing, et cetera. And finally built a model that worked, right? All done in Scala. It was, I think it's unfortunate that people just brush it off as, oh, it's simple. When it is, there's so much that goes into it. There's so much.
I feel excited doing all of that thing because it's not something off the box algorithm that you're using, but you're like creating something hybrid, which is your own. But that will die a sad story because it's going to be named.
Totally. And like when you find this like latent cluster that the organization didn't realize existed, that for me is the most exciting thing, because now you have this group of users that you didn't even know that you could target a certain way. And for me, the end goal is always business impact, right? What am I building that has a legitimate impact? And that has just as much impact as the recommendation system I bought or built. And like you said, it's not sexy, doesn't get as much praise, but I'm with you. I absolutely love it. So it's great stuff.
Absolutely, Madhav. So Madhav, we'll move into one quick section, which we call as the rapid fire round, and we can be candid about it. There are some stupid questions, good questions in it, but
okay, sounds good.
Let's start the rapid fire round for this podcast. What do you prefer, learning by error or learning without error?
Learning by error.
Batman versus Superman.
Batman.
What's something you can't do?
Play piano.
Oh, surprisingly, I'm just learning to play piano using Musician.
That's awesome.
Favorite Walt Disney character?
Oh, wow. Ratatouille.
Most preferred online learning platform?
Coursera.
Do you hire through LinkedIn?
Yes.
Most common mistakes you make while coding?
Not spending enough time on EDA.
What is your favorite note-taking app or tool?
I just use Google Drive documents.
What is your favorite podcast?
I love Data Skeptic and I love How I Built This. Those are my two favorites.
With that, the rapid fire round has ended. We just wanted to get some quick snippets from you. Madhav, so we know data science is a lot thinking heavy, and there is a most balanced approach to how we continue to grow in this field. Balanced would be working and health. So wanted to get something personal out on how your habits look like in terms of health and then your work. So how do you do that?
Yeah, great question that, again, doesn't get discussed nearly enough. A couple things. So one, I always allocate time every day to exercise. And that can be anything from a short 10-minute thing to maybe a 1-hour cycling. I always do that because I've noticed my mental state, my mental kind of sharpness is completely different when I'm exercising versus when I'm not. I just feel more fresh. So that is something I do on a daily basis, at least something. Another thing, be self-aware, right? Don't have a massive ego and just think, this is like such a touchy subject because I hate it because people like glamorize the burnout. And this is very popular in Silicon Valley. They think, oh man, I just worked 70 hours this week. I'm so cool. Like I just hate that it's glamorized. I think it's important to put your ego aside and just acknowledge how are you feeling? How tired are you? And when I do that, if I realize, okay, you know what? This week I can't work that late. It's just too much. I talk to my director. I'm very transparent in my leadership. If you can't be transparent to your leadership or if you feel like they're going to be too harsh, that is somewhere you don't want to be. Honestly, I'll
absolutely
say that point
blank. I agreed with you. Yes.
You don't want to be there. That's not something, because right now Amazon is going through that. There's this really huge influx of toxic culture where there's just this like masculinity with what people are doing. Are people working on weekends? It's terrible. So what I do is I be very transparent with my leadership. And then also because people will, even if you're off, people will still try to set up meetings with you. So what I do is when I've talked to the pertinent people, I've established that I want some, like my afternoon off, I block it on my calendar. I put a long meeting so that everyone, no one's going to book anything. And I use that time for myself. That, I will say, that took me a long time to do because I was in that camp when I first started where I was like, I need to work harder. If I'm not working 70 hours a week, I'm not good enough. But my girlfriend was a great component. Like she gave me a bit of advice there. And also my parents and my like cousins were also in similar fields. They gave me the advice, like, are you gaining anything? Do you really think over the course of a quarter versus the course of a week, over the course of a quarter, if you keep working like this, do you think you'll have more output with the rested schedule versus a hectic schedule? And that was, it's so common sense, but for me, that was eye-opening because because work is a marathon, right? Over the marathon, you actually come out ahead if you take those afternoons off, take the weekend off, etc. Yeah, I think it's so terrible because it's especially Silicon Valley, it's so toxic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the rules that I changed was like shutting off work at 4 p.m. sharp. And that's like no more meetings or no more work after that. And then that significantly changed how I did output at my work. And like suddenly I'm doing more than anybody could ever imagine just by doing that one simple switch.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
totally.
Okay. We'd like to end this podcast with this one question we ask everybody. And this is just more on the lines of picking your brain to see what is important and how data science aspirants basically can think of learning data science in a certain way. And it's more, it can be very personal to you the way you want to put it. And that's totally fine. If you had to learn data science in 3 months, how would you do it today?
I'll take some time. I want to give a good answer. So if you only have 3 months, I would first obviously start learning the basics, right? Imagine if you're a baseline, you have no technical skills. Obviously, you want to learn Python, learn basics of SQL. So I would spend the early portion of that learning the code base that I need to learn. And then I would probably just learn by doing. If you only have 3 months, I would learn by doing. So if I were to do it now, I would probably go to Kaggle and go to those kernels, those really basic kernels, like the Titanic kernel, which I know you've put a YouTube video on. Go to the Titanic kernel, clone it, and just build. Change features and see what happens to the performance. Change the model, see what happens to the performance. Just iterate as much as possible because learning by doing is the easiest, like the best way to learn. I think you could put yourself knee deep into a book and when you get actual data, you're going to be stumped because not everything works like it does in theory. So what I recommend is learning by doing. Start with kind of regression problem. Start with the base. And then start, if you do that enough, you feel comfortable in pandas, etc. Figure out a type of data science that excites you. For me, it was NLP, right? I absolutely love text generation. I played a lot with the GPT models and whatnot, right? Find something that excites you and build that, right? And focus on that. Because I think any prospective employer doesn't want an expert, especially for, say, a junior data scientist at Disney, Google, et cetera, right? They don't expect you to be an expert. They expect you to have the ability to upskill yourself quickly and have passion and show passion. And so that's what I would do in my first 3 months is showcase that passion. You can do that by building a lot of projects for your portfolio, et cetera. But that's kind of how I would start.
Absolutely. And such valuable advice for the data science aspirants, Madhav, and directly coming from someone that is a hands-on person, somebody that knows to communicate with VPs, someone that basically does mentoring and educating himself on a regular basis. That's very valuable. Thank you, Madhav. And thank you, Madhav, for sharing all your journey and little secrets on presentations or metrics and the gaps of this industry. And it was wonderful learning from you. And I think so I'll continue to learn from you and have to ping you a lot on a lot of things, especially presentations and metrics. But thank you for sharing your tips and tricks with us, Madhav.
Of course. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.